from meager beginnings as an adolescent ambulance washer in Moose Jaw, Saskatchewan, to a decade-long legacy of bringing you breaking news before it makes the news, broadcasting live from the studios of Scared Monkeys Radio Network via C-band satellite W3-957, Access Communications Channel 7, and worldwide via digital streaming audio at ScaredMonkeysRadio.com, it's the Dana Pretzer Show. And now, your host, Dana Pretzer.
That's right. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Welcome to all of you, whether you're listening on satellite, on the internet, wherever you can pick us up on the podcast, some of the small stations, Access 7 here in Saskatchewan. Chuck Schumer, well, we all know who he is. He's that nutty senator who's talking about disarming all veterans, if you can imagine. I'm looking at a picture of Chuck with a semi-automatic weapon here, and he, again, a typical liberal attitude as far as weapons go, and I thought I'd bring on someone from the Gun Owners of America to talk about this insanity, and tonight we have Eric Pratt from there. Hi, Eric.
Hey, Dana. It's great to be with you.
Nice to have you on. I've had, that must be your dad, is Larry, is it?
It sure is.
Yeah, I've had your dad on the show a few times. It's nice to have you on the first time. Chuck Schumer is, well, Chuck Schumer. I can't think of another way to explain it that he's Chuck Schumer. This is crazy. Tell us what's going on there.
Well, he's trying to take New York gun control and impose it on the rest of the nation. Yeah, the Veterans Disarmament Act, which you were talking about, will, as indicated, disqualify military veterans, those who've had the shakes, some who are suffering from nightmares, basically the guys coming back have PTSD, post-traumatic stress, things like that. They can be now prevented from owning guns. And that's why the Military Order of the Purple Heart has joined us in opposing this bill. The American Legion has joined us in opposing this bill. And you know, it gets even scarier than that, because it's not just the veterans, although certainly they're one of the bigger groups. But what this bill is going to do is allow psychiatrists, a psychiatrist's determination, and that's the words in the bill, a determination to keep people from owning guns. So if a shrink thinks that you pose even a minuscule danger to yourself or others, whether you're a veteran or whomever, you can be added to the FBI's no gun buy list. And really, you know, this turns the Bill of Rights on its head, because these people are going to be denied without a jury. There's no innocent until proven guilty. You're just put on the list, and then the burden of proof is on you to get that determination overturned. So in other words, it's not the government proving you guilty. You have to prove that you're innocent. So it shifts the burden of proof. It's just completely outrageous.
It's a reverse onus, and why is Schumer looking at this? Is he given any sort of explanation? Are there some cases that he's citing? What's this all about?
Certainly. The big thing that jump-started this bill, he's actually had this bill introduced for several years. And as gun control supporters are apt to do, they wait for the perfect set of circumstances when there's a national tragedy, and they say, aha, see, our legislation will take care of this. And the thing that they point to is Virginia Tech.
Right.
Of course, we point to Virginia Tech and say, you know what? Why is it that all the tragedies that are occurring lately happen in places where guns are banned?
Right.
I mean, what does that tell you?
Exactly.
What that tells you is bad guys don't care about the laws. You know, and they don't go shoot up the police station. They don't go shoot up a gun show. No, they find a place where people are disarmed, where they're going to be the only one with a gun. So really, you know, we would say the answer is that we need to repeal the school zone's gun ban, which prevents principals and teachers. In fact, 85% of the American people support allowing a principal or a teacher to be able to defend the students in the face of a school massacre like that. So what they do is that they point to tragedies like that, and so then they have this bill here that they say, you know, would have stopped the Cho from getting a gun. Well, you know what? I'd like to see what gun law has ever been written that has stopped the bad guy who really wanted a gun, has stopped them from getting one.
Yeah, if they really want one, they're going to get one. There's, I'm not sure if you're familiar with the case, but there's a teacher that's been prevalent in the media here in the last little while who is a licensed concealed weapon carrier. However, the school district is not allowing her to bring the weapon on to school property. Cho is a great example. Your dad and I talked about that here when that happened. A little bit later on, I'm going to cover the story of the Wisconsin deputy who took his semi-automatic issued rifle and tragically took a bunch of young lives. Again, this law would not have prevented that. From the perspective of your organization, the Gun Owners of America, what can we do? Because there is that public sentiment. They look at Canada, for example, England. They look at statistics that sway the way of the gun bans and don't look at the big picture. But I'm curious what your organization's thoughts are when you do address a situation.
Sure. Actually, well, a couple things on that. You know, you mentioned Canada and England, and we would say, yeah, let's look at Canada and England. It's interesting that when England had their schoolyard tragedy, by the way, that they had more stringent gun control than we did when that occurred back in, I think it was 1996, because right. In 1997, they just, you know, the pendulum swung the whole way, and they virtually banned all the firearms on the island. And what's interesting is that now, according to the United Nations, England has a higher crime rate than all the industrialized nations of the earth, including the United States. So, you know, you would think if gun control was going to work on an island, if it was going to work anywhere, it would work on an island, and yet it's failed in England. They have a worse crime problem than ever. It's even higher than ours. Same thing with Canada. Canada has had very stringent gun controls as well, and yet even within the last year, there was a school shooting. So, you know, there again, strict gun control doesn't stop bad guys who want a gun from getting a gun. So, you know, what your question is then, what do we do? Well, there's a lot that people can do, and one of the easiest ways to take action is to go to our website at gunowners.org. That's gunowners with an S, .org, O-R-G. And we've got a lot of alerts. In fact, we've got a whole special section on this Veterans Disarmament Act. The bill number is H.R. 2640. But because of the outpouring of grassroots opposition against this bill, it is stalled in the Senate. And it's made senators take another look at this, much to the chagrin of Schumer, who is really trying to ram this through. Senator Tom Coburn of Oklahoma has had a hold on this, on this legislation. He's got amendments that he wants to offer to it. And so we're encouraging people to contact their senators to join Senator Coburn in this effort. I mean, it flew through the House. It flew through the Senate Judiciary Committee both times on an unrecorded voice vote. I mean, how's that for cowardice? You know, they didn't want to stand up and have their names be counted on this. So it was all voice vote, all unrecorded vote, both in the Senate Judiciary and in the full House of Representatives. But by our active opposition and working with Senator Tom Coburn, this legislation has stalled, and now when it comes, people are going to have to start voting on it. And so that's a positive thing. That's something that that could end up buying us a lot of time and perhaps even kill this.
Well, yeah, Schumer's out to lunch when it comes to this, and something that we've covered quite a bit on my program and others is, again, if the punishment the punishment should fit the crime. Easy for me to say. mandatory minimum sentencing. Now I'll get the rag out of my mouth yet tonight. Those that commit crimes with guns. Is that a deterrent, in your opinion?
Regarding mandatory minimums?
Someone uses a gun in a crime, okay? We're not talking about taking the guns away. We're talking about, like you say, the criminals, the chos, etc., they'll get the gun no matter what.
Yeah.
But if they use that gun, they should be punished properly. In Canada, they don't. In the United States, they don't.
Yeah, I mean, we do agree that they need to be punished severely. And quite frankly, if they commit murder, we're of the mindset that they should forfeit their life as well. And unfortunately, we don't do that. You know, every state in the union, if they have capital punishment, they average about one or two executions a year, and that just simply doesn't keep pace with the number of murders that are occurring. You know, you mentioned mandatory minimums, and one of the things that gives us hesitation about that, those specifically, is that a lot of times we have seen, or we've seen it enough times, where somebody who uses a gun legitimately in self-defense gets hit by one of those. You know, maybe they were a clerk at a store, and they end up shooting the mugger in the back or something like that, and so they'll prosecute, you know, ignoring the whole self-defense thing. And we've seen people go to jail for several years on that. So, you know, that for that reason, it gives us hesitation. But we are in full agreement. If you, you know, commit cold-blooded murder, oh my goodness, you know, there is no reason you should ever be walking the streets again.
The media and how they've handled cases like this. We're just in our last few minutes here with Eric Pratt from the Gun Owners of America. You see the stories covered, slanted, especially in the liberal media, one way. You do see some positive stories here or there. But now with the reality television and a lot of the stuff that we see, we also see a mockery of the responsibility of owning a firearm and being trained and capable in using one. What are your thoughts on how the media has been covering these sorts of stories?
Well, it's despicable, and I appreciate, you know, shows like yours, Dana, where, you know, we can get the truth out. But it's absolutely despicable. I mean, in recent days, of course, we were treated to the tragedy in Wisconsin, the tragedy in Ohio. So Americans have seen coast to coast two tragedies where a gun was used illegitimately. And yet, firearms are used every day 80 times more often to save life than to take life. And yet, you know, people, you know, if you hear me saying that, you're like, well, but wait a minute, why don't I see those stories? You know, I mean, I only see the negative cases, but where, you know, if they're really happening that often, why aren't there the positive stories? Well, that's because the media doesn't tell the whole story, the mainstream media. And I'll give you a perfect example of that, and it relates to what we've been talking about, because all the school shootings that have ended abruptly have been ended by a good guy with a gun, a teacher, a principal, somebody like that. And a classic case of this was Mississippi in 1997, Pearl, Mississippi. Luke Woodham, a student, took his gun into the high school and started shooting and killing people, unfortunately. Well, there was an assistant principal there, Joel Myrick, who had a gun in his car, ran to his car, grabbed his firearm, ran back, and stopped Luke Woodham dead in his tracks. Luke did not kill another person or injure another person that day. Joel Myrick is a hero. Well, unfortunately, while that story, that school shooting, made coast-to-coast headlines the next day, and for the next week, I mean, that was, you know, the Good Morning America, you know, all the talk shows, you know, they were all talking about this. Hundreds of stories in newspapers, less than 10 stories mention that Joel Myrick used a gun to stop the shooter. So, you know, hundreds of stories talking about the bad guy using a gun illegitimately, less than 10, I think the number was 4. 4 stories told the whole truth that an assistant principal used a gun in a positive way to save lives. And see, and that's why, I mean, that right there in a nutshell is why people aren't seeing the overwhelming number of positive uses of firearms.
Yeah, for sure. Eric Pratt from the Gun Owners of America, thank you. I know you came on for your dad tonight, but you both are, and all the people in your organization are doing a great job, and you're always welcome on my program.
Well, Dana, thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Take care. We'll talk soon.
All right. Sounds great.
Bye-bye. You are listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. My name's Dana Pretzer. We'll be back in a minute with retired FBI agent Clint Van Zandt.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
Okay, we're back. This is the Dana Pretzer Show here on Scared Monkeys Radio. Sad case out of Wisconsin. An off-duty sheriff's deputy, Tyler Peterson, lost control when he got into an argument with his girlfriend and her friends when they called him a worthless pig. He went out and got his recently issued AR-15 rifle from his vehicle, went back into the house, and fired 30 shots. All but one of the people in the party were killed. The deputy later took his own life, we hear. 20 years old. I thought I'd bring on Clint Van Zandt tonight to talk about maturity and being able to handle a job like being a police officer at 20. For those of you that don't know, I started my police career at 18, and I will agree the fact that you're not mature enough at that age to carry a badge and a gun. Clint, how are you?
Good evening, Dana. Just fine, thank you.
This is another tragedy, and I appreciate you coming on to spend some time with us. Now, you and I talked off air a little bit about the age, and I know you've written an article for MSNBC.com talking about the same thing. Was this deputy too young? Is that part of this?
Well, you and I know that age is not necessarily a measure, the full measure, I should say, of emotional maturity. I mean, We have young men and women going out to fight in war at 17 and 18, 19, 20 years old. I mean, they're given a 9mm pistol and a M16 rifle and told to defend themselves and fight for their country and die if they have to. I think there's questions over all of our levels of maturity. The issue here is that I think it's challenging for a young man as young as he, when you stay in the exact same house and town. Now realize, he's from a town of 1,955 people. So he's a full-time deputy sheriff. He's a part-time police officer. He's a part-time college student who's trying to maintain a peer relationship with kids, adolescents, young men and women, a little younger and a little older than him, and at the same time trying to function as a law enforcement officer who has authority over people. I think that's a very tough balance for somebody to have to maintain.
Psychological maturity, and from your perspective as a profiler and all your experience in law enforcement and in the FBI, there had to have been more than just calling him a worthless pig, because you and I both know, Clint, in our early days that being called a pig was, I wished I had a buck for every time I was called one. What made this kid snap?
Well, you know, I remember the first time as an FBI agent, somebody called me a pig. And it was a combination of I laughed to myself and I almost felt honored.
Right.
It felt good. I mean, that's okay. If that's what you, because of course that was when I was an FBI agent in the 70s, obviously that was a very derogatory term that was attached to police officers and law enforcement. And you know, I thought men and women then, as they do now, do a darn good job. But in this particular case, I mean, you don't go out and get an assault rifle and start killing people because they call you a pig. In his case, I think there was boyfriend-girlfriend issues. And again, he carried this emotional baggage probably for months. And there he was, confronted by his peers, thinking, if they call me this name, how are they ever going to respect me when I have my badge and my gun and my uniform? I realize this is a young man who people say, when he was in high school, that was just 2 years ago, Dana.
Right.
When he was in high school, he was picked on all the time. So you have to question, why sometimes do people go into law enforcement for the wrong reasons? Do they go into law enforcement not because they want to help people, but because they want to have some level of authority and respect that they couldn't have any other way without the badge, uniform, and gun?
There's questions in the media about this deputy not getting any psychological screening. From the perspective of psychological screening, which may be an interview or two, maybe 8 hours, maybe more, how reliable would that be, and would that have changed things here?
Well, I think there's two things that could have been done. Number one is, you know, a very thorough background investigation, or perhaps you would have went out and found his peers and said, you know, how did he relate to his friends? Was he respected? Was he not respected? And hopefully it would have come out that, oh, yeah, guys picked on him. And that's something that I would have wanted to pursue with him in a applicant interview. I mean, as an FBI agent, I used to do interviews on guys who were being considered candidates. They were already FBI agents, and they were candidates for our tactical teams. And we administered MMPIs and 16PFs. We used various psychological instruments, but the value of that was there was a different curve that we would have for men and women who were risk takers in a positive sense, who were willing to put it all on the line, maybe more than their peers who just did the normal job. But you still had to explore that. Were they doing it for the right reasons? And when I heard that this young man, I realized this is probably a very small sheriff's department and even a smaller police department, but they did no psychological testing whatsoever. And this guy was sworn in about a year ago, Dana, so that means he was about 19 when he came on the job, and he has already been through SWAT training and was issued this AR-15 that he used to kill these other kids with. I mean, the question then is not only was he too young to be in law enforcement, and I think that's a measure of emotional maturity as much as anything, but should somebody that new in law enforcement go in the SWAT? And the answer there, I think, is no.
Absolutely. Clint Van Zandt is here with me. It's a tragedy no matter what. Well, I've got you for a couple more minutes here, Clint. Can you give us an update on the Madeleine McCann investigation? You and I talked about this last time you were on.
Sure. Yeah, of course, this is a case of this last May where this then 3-year-old little British girl, the daughter of two 38-year-old British doctors, she and her twin 2-year-old brother and sisters were put to bed by her parents in a motel, and then the parents allegedly went to dinner at a restaurant right at this hotel about 100 yards away, and within an hour and a half or so, the mother came back to check on the children, found out her 3-year-old daughter was missing and has been missing ever since. And the issues come up with the Portuguese police, whose investigative capabilities I really question right now, whether she wandered off on her own, and if she did, why couldn't we find her, or whether, as the Portuguese police suggest, that her parents either accidentally killed her by corporal punishment, or perhaps they gave her a sedative, wanting her to sleep the night so that they could go eat and drink with their friends, and then somehow was able to conceal her body and then take the body away and dispose of it. Now, realize this Portuguese police department, and especially this particular unit, is led by a senior investigator. This is the same senior investigator who 3 years ago arrested a single woman, charging her with the disappearance of her young daughter, again, a young girl who's never been found, but in that particular case, allegedly beat a confession out of this woman, sent her to prison, and just late, that has come out. Officers have been suspended, and the lead investigator in that case of the alleged beating of this woman was the same lead investigator in the Madeleine McCann case, who's just been removed from the case. So, I mean, to me, as much as I embrace law enforcement, that gives me reason to take a step back and say, if that level of lack of professional competency is there, what else might they have done wrong, and what might they have missed in this investigation?
Yeah, for sure. That's, it's a tragedy, and hopefully we'll get some answers. Clint Van Zandt, retired FBI agent, someone who's on NBC more than the NBC Peacock, I think, some days. Thanks, Clint.
Thanks, Dana.
Take care, buddy. Bye-bye. And that's Clint Van Zandt. I want to share with you just quickly a release that Rita Cosby sent me. Rita Cosby, as you know, has come under attack here recently, and in fact, including tonight, I believe, on Fox News, regarding a recent trip to the Bahamas in regards to a civil suit that's been filed against her by Howard K. Stern. You know my story about Howard K. Stern and his lawyer, Lynn Wood. Rita Cosby sent me this. She's under scrutiny right now about a recent trip to the Bahamas where it's alleged that she tried to bribe a couple of potential sources that were in her book, two nannies that may have witnessed a tryst between Howard K. Stern and Larry Birkhead. Again, that's not confirmed by me. Rita Cosby sent me this as far as what's been going on with her lately. This is a statement from Rita Cosby. I'm reading it to you. I believe people will see this for what it really is. The nannies who reported seeing the sex tape told private investigators about this. They spoke directly to Don Clark, the former head of FBI divisions in Texas and New York, who has now issued a statement emphasizing that he met and spoke directly with the women who told him about the sex tape and stated Anna would watch it. Don Clark is a 25-year veteran in law enforcement. I would also refer you to the website run by the agent for the nannies, Lincoln Bain, where he says, quote, Rita Cosby wrote a book claiming that Howard and Larry are lovers. Good Lord. That good Lord is me saying that. Damn, I could have told her that. In fact, Anna's former nannies told that to several media groups months ago. The media was afraid to touch it, but I'm glad that it is out. That's a statement from Rita Cosby regarding the recent controversy regarding her trip to the Bahamas and the lawsuit filed against her by Howard K. Stern. Again, that is a statement by Rita Cosby. We'll be back in a minute with Andrew Hodges. Remember him? He's the Forensic Thought Prints guy, and he has a Natalie Holloway update. Stay tuned for that.
You're listening to Scared Monkeys Radio. Once again, here's your host, Dana Pretzer.
That's right, and we are back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio. I'll remind you, the website is www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's www.scaredmonkeysradio.com. Andrew Hodges is with me tonight. You remember him? We talked about forensic thought prints and how it related to the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Andrew, how are you?
Good, Dan. It's good to be with you.
Nice to have you back on the show this evening. I know you have a book out, but I wanted to bring you, and we'll talk about the book in a minute, I wanted to bring you back on to talk about the Holloway investigation. Recently, Beth Holloway has been in the media. In fact, she'll be a guest of mine on Monday talking about her new book. And you have some information about that investigation that you'd like to share with the audience.
Well, my book, Into the Deep, is just out, which speaks for itself. I have a profile on the case, which briefly I've discussed with Beth. It was interesting. She teared up when I told her she was the one responsible for eliciting, primarily the one responsible for eliciting this confession from Deepak, whose crucial email was the one that provided the profile, five-page email. Typical of criminals who confess between the lines, who have a great need to confess. I think this is what we're learning in forensic science, that people, no matter how hardened the sociopath or how hardened the criminal appears deep down, everybody knows right from wrong, they have a need to confess. So if my profile led me to see that the body is in the ocean, that it's discoverable, that it's in a cage, it's in a place in the ocean which is identified in the profile in the email between the lines. So in turn, I've worked closely with Dave Holloway. He and I've been in extensive discussion, and then Tim Miller with Texas Equisearch, and there is certainly definite plans for a search, as Tim has announced in the media. And sometimes in the later part of the fall, there will be a definite search, and all of us are anticipating a very successful search. I think there's no question about it. It's in the crab cage. It went missing. The whole question is, does the crab cage move? It stays. It's heavy. It's on the bottom of the ocean. Has it held together? And these are very sturdy cages, and I think it's going to be discoverable. Tim has some excellent equipment that's advanced over his previous search, and he didn't get to continue it about a year ago. So I think the search is going to be successful. I think it's going to be a striking finding.
So for those that missed our last interview, maybe you could explain a little bit, Andrew, about what a forensic thought print is.
Sure. Dan, it's a forensic thought print is basically, it's an idea expressed symbolically, but if a person communicates between the lines, the unconscious mind is brilliant. It picks up on what the story is. It has a need to confess, and the way it does, it'll repeat the same idea 10 different ways. So, for example, in Deepak's email, you can see it's a confession. He gives you, the first thing you want to know is what, Natalie alive or dead? and he gives you 10 different thoughts of her death, in terms of missing, but he'll, missing is one way, but he'll have thoughts of closing time, he'll have thoughts of the music stopped, he'll have thoughts of she fell asleep, many different patterns, and he'll do this at crucial moments, so he's telling you right off that she is deceased. He makes a crucial slip right off, and he says the missing girl, Natalie Holloway, A-W-A-Y, instead of O-W-A-Y. But he's telling you she's gone away somewhere, and then he gives you that code for, he's got to tell you what happened, and he then will describe the sexual assault between the lines. Numerous sexual innuendos. So you see a sexual innuendo code. You can describe, you know, sexual innuendo can be used to, you can have 10 different sexual innuendos with the same meaning. So he described a rape, a brutal assault. He was the one assaulting her at the moment that she died. The way he describes her death is an aspiration. He describes references of too much to drink and too much liquids and so forth. And so if you follow the profile, he's going to tell you that she died. He's going to tell you that this was caused by a rape. He's going to give repeated ideas, what I call thought prints, different symbolic thoughts representing the same idea that she aspirated. She also fought. And then he interestingly gives you a timeline, which we can discuss in a second, but he goes through that and gives you, okay, we want to know what they do with the body. Well, they put the body in the ocean. Well, did they dump her or just, you know, float her body out in the ocean, or what did they do? Well, they put it in a cage, and he gives you references to the ocean, give you disguise symbols for the ocean in the drink. Holiday Inn is becomes a code in the letter for the ocean, if you think of the Holiday Inn is right on the ocean, and the end of Natalie Holloway, the Holloway Inn, where she's staying, and so forth. But you can see his symbolism, how he's telling you she's in the ocean. But if they do an interesting thing, they have to describe a container. How do you describe a container? You can do it many different ways, but one way they do it is a small enclosure within a larger enclosure. So one of those is, if the Holiday Inn is ocean, then she's staying in a room in the Holiday Inn, and he emphasizes over and over, where is she, wake her up, she's staying at the Holiday Inn, so forth, and confirm it with her, wake her up again. So there's this emphasis on the Holiday Inn, and then within the Holiday Inn, she's in a particular location, a room, a small enclosure within a large enclosure. He does this many different ways, but he's emphasizing the idea of a container, a small space within a larger space. And then they emphasize she's staying a place. She's staying. She's not moving. This is how he tells you the cage is there. And all of this is between the lines, but you have to know of the breakthrough to the unconscious mind and how these criminals confess. So he's telling you all these things, and he really gives you instructions. People deep down unconsciously want to confess because they want to be free from this horrific guilt, and that's what he's doing. And as I told Beth, you know, it was interesting when I talked to her about this. I told her, I said, and this is referenced in the email. He and Yaron came up to Beth that very night, the first night after Natalie's disappeared. Beth and Jug and all of them were down there. Big encounter with Jug. Jug and his followers or supporters are really, it's very combative, and there was a lot of tension. Beth is off in the background. Finally, Yaron and Deepak at the end of the evening go up to Beth and hoping for a good cop, so to speak, in the face of bad cop Jug. And they go up and say, well, ma'am, we didn't do it. We want you to know we didn't do it. And basically, Beth looked Deepak and Yaron in the face and said, looked them in the eye and said, listen, you're lying through your teeth. I don't believe a word you're saying. I'm going to make your life a living hell. Now, there are two crimes here. One is, You participate in the death, and I think it was an accidental death, but it was an intentional rape of this of Natalie. But then you don't give the body back, and that's a double crime. I mean, you ask anybody who doesn't has unfinished business, it's an awful thing.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were two crimes, and Deepak couldn't stand up to it. He couldn't stand up to his own conscience, and so then he broke and he wrote this letter. And as I explained, there were two other pressures that caused him to break and write this extensive letter five days after the crime. When I told Beth this, you know, I told her, I said, you know, you really did something important. See, she really teared up, you know, it just got to her. And she said, you know, she described to me going to see Deepak at his internet store. And she said, you know, I went over there to confront him. She said, I used to teach kids. She said he could never look her in the eye again. He couldn't look at her, you know. And she leaned on him very hard and got a confession out of him. So he's really telling us where the body is. And what's interesting is I've gone over the details. And I don't want to go over all the details of what everybody's thinking, but I can tell you it's there in my profile. And the details match exactly what Tim and Dave and have been able to put together about where the body is from very key sources that have not been totally made public.
Some media outlets, Andrew, have reported, in particular Bill O'Reilly on Fox News, is that he had credible information from a source who he won't reveal, and that's his prerogative, that Natalie died of an overdose. However, that's leaving that window wide open, because that overdose could have been a, you know, for example, a date rape drug that was administered to her. What are your thoughts on that?
I'll tell you, interesting. Dave and I talked about that at length just yesterday, and Dave was thinking GHB and so forth. I'll tell you, the most reliable source on this case is from the mind of one of the three suspects. And I show in my book, we now have Deepak's email, we have Yaron's book, and we have the police interviews. And you can read between the lines in all of them. I trust the deeper mind. I've researched the unconscious mind for 25 to 30 years. What nobody knows, I wrote a book called The Deeper Intelligence, and people don't know how bright it is, how honest it is. It insists on telling the truth deep down. And so I trust this mind. I trust that mind of the unconscious mind of all three suspects. I will tell you, this is vastly superior to any whatever source Bill O'Reilly has. And I can tell you what this email says, and I'm absolutely, absolutely positive he's wrong in this sense. I don't think it all was a date rape drug. I think what they did was they used the drug. I think what they used was ecstasy.
Right.
And there's a clue in the letter that they used that. He keeps referring to the word ETC, which if you look at it is ecstasy, and this, you know, it's got an embedded hint at ecstasy. The reason they didn't use, wouldn't have used GHB is it would, in the end, GHB leaves you impaired, unconscious. They didn't want an unconscious girl off somewhere on their hands. They wanted to get her back after the rape and get her back to her peers and hope she would go home, you know, embarrassed and ashamed and not confess. That was their modus operandi. I don't think GHB entered the picture. I don't think that's what they wanted. The one story that came out in the police interviews and so forth that a girl reported Yaron had given her something, and she said, you know, my lips tingled. This is someone else. This is classical of a stimulant. This is typical of a euphoria and typical of ecstasy. Natalie's behavior was typical of somebody that I think she'd been probably drugged with some ecstasy in a drink. And, you know, she was euphoric. She was leaning out the window yelling at people, this is not GHB.
Right.
You know, so I think the evidence, and Dave and I went over this and all the reasons, and he now agrees with me, that she was likely given ecstasy in her drink unknowingly with alcohol. Ecstasy with alcohol produces a tremendous aphrodisiac in certain situations, and I think that's what they were counting on. And I think they were hoping that they would get her off and have her on drugs and have her on alcohol, and then that she would willingly go along. And I think if you read the stories and the between the lines, they got Natalie out there, and the timeline's very interesting. I mean, they were at their crime scene at 1:30, and that's when that assault began. They left Carlos and Charlie's at 1:15. If you go through my profile, he does this in the letter. He gives you very specific times. I think at that point, and Deepak describes this in his police interviews, he popped in a porno video in Yaron, and I think at that point Natalie knew she was in trouble, and I think they offered her, you know, a chance to go along with a voluntary threesome, a voluntary assault, and she said no. And the timeline I think is real important in his email, and I go into that in the book. So I don't think this was a date rape and a drug. I think this was a more of a encouraging type drug of ecstasy, but not GHB. And I don't think it was cocaine. I don't know who told O'Reilly that, but I wouldn't believe that.
Well, that wasn't the first time that he'd come forward with his so-called secret source.
What got me, Dana, is he said overdose.
Yeah.
He did not die of an overdose. He died of an overdose of her own vomitus and throwing up.
Exactly.
Be frank.
Yeah, absolutely.
Is a physician. That's what she died of, and she died in a struggle. She put up a fight. You don't put up a fight in an overdose. I mean, or you know, so this was not an overdose death. I think if that was the case, they might have brought her home and said, well, you know, we didn't give it to her, and we didn't know she had it, and gee, this was too bad. I think an overdose, they would have just kind of brought the body somewhere. This body had trauma, evidence of trauma, you know. And so whatever O'Reilly's source is, I would put by far and away trust the deeper mind of a suspect, you know.
Well, when we look at the deeper mind of a suspect, and we just have a couple of minutes left, Andrew, we're dealing with sociopaths, narcissistic personalities. How does that affect their forensic thought prints?
Because, you know, that's a great question, because I was the one guy. I was involved in the BTK case. I was nearly called in at the end, but they already had him. But someone very close to the law enforcement there wanted me in on it. But I was profiling his letters. He was communicating with the police, and that's what got him caught. But I said, this guy's about to kill again. From his profile, reading between the lines, if you go back to his case, he was talking about running a temperature. He was joking about making references to skillets and warming up and ho, ho, ho. And
yeah,
he was making all these references to temperature and things getting hotter. And I said, this guy is telling you he's warming up and he's on the verge of killing. That's why I went public with my profile. The local profilers up there didn't like that, and they said I was scaring the people. I said, I'm not scaring people. I'm telling you, he's getting ready to kill again. They said, well, he hadn't killed again in years. He's not stalking anybody. As soon as he was arrested, he confessed to stalking.
Right.
And he was a very narcissistic, sociopathic guy on one level. But deep in, he has this conscience, and he had to confess. And so that's a good example, you know, of how he couldn't stop himself. And BTK got himself caught. And that's exactly what Deepak's doing here.
Absolutely. The book is Deeper Intelligence, available.
Yeah, that's my old book, but this book is Into the Deep.
Into the Deep.
The Hidden Confession of Natalie's Killer. And, you know, it's on Amazon. You can go see it. But my former book was The Deeper Intelligence, which is the basis of my profiling.
Okay. Again, the book is Into the Deep, and again, it's available Amazon, all those other places.
That's it.
All right. Andrew Hodges, always nice to have you on the show.
Dana, thank you for having me. I enjoyed it.
Take care, sir.
Have a good night.
Bye-bye. We'll be back in just a minute here on Scared Monkeys Radio with Jackie Hollander, who has an important announcement for you.
And now, more of the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. Here's Dana.
That's right, we are back. This is Scared Monkeys Radio, and I'll remind you, our webpage is scaredmonkeysradio.com. That's a good name for a webpage that has to do with Scared Monkeys Radio. Now, whatever. Jackie Hollander has been a regular guest on the program. She is a rape victim. She is a advocate for rape victims. She was instrumental in helping a law change that dealt with term limits, statute of limitations when it came to rape, and she's on the line here with me now to talk about something exciting that will involve this program. Hi, Jackie.
Hi, Dana. How are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to have you back on the air. Let's talk a little bit about what's going on next Friday.
Next Friday, I will be in Carbondale, Illinois. It's about 6 hours, really, from where I'm at right now. And so it's the University, the Southern University of Illinois. They're going to be having the Take Back the Night with, and I'm sure you know what Take Back the Night is,
right,
here in the States.
And what's going to happen there? How are you involved with this? And how can we be involved with this with the program?
Well, I've been asked to be their guest speaker, which I will be.
Wow.
And, of course, there'll be a lot of women down there because they're coming from all over.
Mm-hmm.
And they're actually going to march. And Take Back the Night is a night of remembrance of many rape victims, survivors of sexual assault, and those that we've lost because of sexual assault and rape. What is so great about this has never been done before. And we're going to be doing it with you live. So It'll be live from Carbondale, Illinois, with thousands of women and you.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. And just for those that aren't sure, you know, right now you've been on the program two or three times. Let's talk a little bit about what you had to go through. And, of course, the great work that you've done now, and I don't think that the organization could have picked a better guest speaker than yourself, because
Oh, thank you. You
are the voice right now. You've taken command, so to speak, and you are speaking for those that haven't been able to speak for themselves. Let's talk about you a little bit.
Well, I mean, you know, I spent, and the world knows, I spent 19 years, through a lot of intimidation and harassment because of James Brown. And that's what I want to see on next Friday night, is that these women are not locked in a closet when they come down there. Their voices will be heard all over the internet and I guess all around the world with you. And I think that's very important, because I don't think any woman should ever have to walk in my shoes in silence and in fear. And I'm very blessed tonight, because I actually have a very special guest listening to me tonight, and that's my brother.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm very happy.
And say hi to your brother. You just did, I guess.
Hi, Bob. I love you. I guess when you've been going through what I've been going through, you know, the Supreme Court, and then, of course, the years of Mr. Brown, and the having to hide and run, and you don't get to spend a lot of time with your family, and now, of course, the law changing and the time that I was spending down there, you just don't get to see your family and tell them you love them as much as you would like to.
And then how important is family? It's huge.
Very, very important. And you know, I mean, I was very blessed that they loved me in spite of everything, and you know, supported me. And I mean, there were times, of course, when you're a rape victim, that no matter how many people are around you, you're still alone. And I was very much alone, and I was very much afraid, and just trying to survive each day to stay alive. And of course, I think I've said this on your show before, there actually came a moment in time on July 4th where I did load a pistol, because I did not want the harassment to go on my family.
And you know, that when it comes to that extreme, thank God it never happened, because you know, inside of you, you used all your strength to survive, and you thought you were, you know, to use the term, out of gas, so to speak, and there was a little bit left in the tank, but hell, girl, that tank's full now, and you're going full bore ahead.
Well, it was actually law enforcement that kind of came to my rescue. I think they had seen me declining, and not everybody knew the story, but a lot of people did, and they saw the decline, and they saw me basically slipping that July 4th, and I just couldn't walk in my shoes anymore. They were way too much, and I was too afraid, and I thought that if I was gone, if, you know, because I knew that's what they wanted anyway, that if I was gone, they would leave the people that I loved alone. And I thank God that I had the intervention to save my life. That's why it's so important that these girls down there know, when they show up down there next week, that you are their gate. You're opening your door, and you're allowing the world, the first time ever, I think anything like this has ever been done on the internet, is a Take Back the Night live, so that these victims can be heard on your show and throughout, and they're not living in silence. They're being heard.
Well, I can guarantee you've got my full support. Jackie Hollander, it's Take Back the Night. It'll be next Friday from Carbondale, Illinois, and we'll be heard here live on the Dana Pretzer Show. Jackie, talk to me next week, and we'll work out the details.
Thank you so much, Dana, and I mean, can't wait to join you. They say it's going to be cold. I'm going to have to wear a sweater or a coat. They say it's going to be really cold down there.
Well, I was hoping I could be there with you in person, but we'll do it this way, and it works just as well.
We sure will.
Okay, we'll talk to you next week.
Thank you.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Yeah, I'm looking forward to that. Our next show will be Monday night, 9 o'clock Eastern. Beth Holloway Twitty will be here to talk about her new book, Loving Natalie. And then, of course, we're going to do the special Take Back the Night from Carbondale, Illinois, where we'll be supporting thousands of rape victims. That's next Friday. So stay tuned to the webpage at scaredmonkeysradio.com for more details. The show will be available for podcast a little bit later on this evening. Thank you for listening. Good night.
You've been listening to the Dana Pretzer Show on Scared Monkeys Radio. We invite you to discuss tonight's program with other listeners by joining us at scaredmonkeysradio.com, where you'll find program archives, links to tonight's guests' websites, and further information regarding tonight's topics. Scared Monkeys Radio is a production of scaredmonkeys.com. Thanks for listening. We'll be right back.